Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And Jen Romolini, you finished your book this week.
Woo, I fucking turned it in. Yes, it's over. I mean, I can't even tell you, like, time has new meaning. I'm just, like, last night before I went to bed, I was like, oh my God, I can read anything I want, because for the past like 5 days, I had only read the last two pages of like 100 books, because I was like, how do people end a book? Anyway, it doesn't fucking matter. Let's never talk about it again. We are very energetic, and very happy for the fact that we have a serious show today. Rebecca Sofer is our guest. She's going to be talking about modern loss, her new book, The Modern Loss Handbook, but mostly she's talking about grief and all the different forms of grieving and how we can show up for not only ourselves, but for other people who are in the process of grieving. And she's lovely and delightful and so smart, and it's a really good conversation. Before that, let's have a check-in. How are you, Kim France?
I'm fine. I don't, you know, Jen, I don't have a lot to report today. I gotta tell you. I just don't. Okay. I can sleep well. I feel like a zombie. And I'm very upset. I mean, this will be a little dated, but certainly still newsworthy by the time this comes out. But, like, we just found out about the Supreme Court Roe versus Wade business yesterday. And I don't know anybody who isn't really upset by that today.
I think that I'm trying to be in denial about it. I can see myself trying to be sort of toxic positivity about it. I'm like, well, thank God there are abortion pills now. Like, it's fucking awful. It is awful, 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 awful.
It is beyond awful. I mean, I'll say it. I've had 2 abortions. And, you know, I had them both when I was in my early 20s. And my life would have been a disaster if I had had either of those children. I can't even imagine. I mean, I would have taken an entirely different route. I would have been attached to men who I didn't want to be attached to for the rest of my life. But I'm not thinking about people like me. I'm thinking about, like, people with very little access to education or help and what that journey gets like for them. I mean, it's just fucking depressing.
It's just abortion should be legal. It is a human right. It is a decision that you should be able to make about your fucking body. It's like, you know, we all go to, like, oh, rape and incest. No, it should just be a regular thing. This, you know, because we have no social safety nets in this country. We pretend that we are pro-life, but we are not actually pro-life. We are pro-pregnancy. Yeah. I can't. And if I think about it too long, I just can't. I've been fighting. I feel like I've been fighting for pro-choice issues since I was 16. Yeah. And the fact that we are here is, it's so obviously believable, but at the same time, it's like, it's hard to believe. We saw it happening in real time.
And I'm so angry about that. What do? I give my $60 a month to Planned Parenthood, but what else do I do?
I have been trying to take some action. I have, and I put it on my Instagram account and my link in bio. If anybody's interested, I have found a Google Doc from a very good reproductive health activist that gives a lot of action items, including how to talk about this on social media, including where to be supporting right now, because we're all giving our money to the biggest players, but actually locally is where where our money is going to go the furthest. We do what we can, and we show up in elections, and we try not to let this make us feel so defeated that we stop participating. I feel like that's the worst thing that could happen at this moment.
I think it, I think you're absolutely right. I just read a line in the Times or somewhere about how, like, this is how the vast majority of America wants to see women as vessels. You know, as vessels. It is so, what's the Margaret Atwood book?
What's Handmaid's Tale.
Thank you. It's having a little marshmallow brain moment. It's really, it is so dark. I can only hope that this generation of younger women is going to mobilize around this.
And not just, you know, non-binary people, you know,
you're right.
Trans men. Like, this affects any assigned female at birth body. And we have to make sure that we're inclusive in that language too.
Yeah.
And it is just, ugh, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I want to talk about something else. I want to talk about beard dyers.
Which I didn't know was a thing.
Okay. Now that you know it's a thing, you're going to start looking for it everywhere. I think there are men who are as vain as any woman in the world, obviously. And they are out there because I had this thought the other day. I was looking at an actor and I was like, he's around my age. That man has gray hair. And that man has a fucking gray beard. That man with that full beard that he is using to disguise his old man neck. That man has a gray beard, and that man's beard is dyed. And now I can't stop seeing it. Now that I've seen it once, if you look at this, I think this has been happening for all of our days. I think men have been dyeing their beards forever. I think Affleck dyes his beard. I think all the men in midlife and beyond dye their beard. And you can kind of tell because all of these men's beards look a little off. They're like a little orange. And I'm telling you to look. That's all I'm saying.
That's hilarious.
Beard dyers.
And if you say Affleck does it, I believe you. Because I don't think I don't know a more astute Ben Affleck observer than you.
Well, I'll tell you that he does it carefully because he's got J-Lo in his corner. He does it carefully. He does it half and half. So he doesn't have the Santa beard, because that's the other thing. They're all desperate not to have the Santa beard.
Bobby.
So he's a careful beard dyer. Some people just go full on and it starts to look really dumb. Other thing I want to talk about is I have found a real new style inspiration, and her name is Aja Barber, and she is many things, but she is this style icon on Instagram, and she has, you know, not a pin thin body. And she doesn't buy any fast fashion. And she just does these outfits of the day of herself with her full, real middle-aged body, starting in her underwear and then putting on an outfit, putting an outfit together. And she has incredible style. And it's so fun to watch, but she also talks about the places she sources her clothes, which are all, you know, not fast fashion, all pretty earth friendly. And also tracking down things that she wanted for a long time, but finding them secondhand, vintage. So it's a very inspiring source for fashion and also information about, you know, the toxic areas of fashion that we don't like to talk about too much.
There was a big conversation on her Facebook group this week.
Yes, there was. And that's what made me think about it. Yes. About how do we dress right now? Where are you buying clothes?
Do you buy clothes? It's really hard. We have a guest coming on in a few weeks, who I think is going to be great for this. But it is a real question. When you reach a certain age, like I can't go on Shopbop anymore.
No.
It's like, I can't, something just happened. Maybe they changed their vibe. And I think I just can't look at that anymore as my baseline of like,
no. I mean, for me, it's just always, it's like a constant, you know, aging is just a constant adjusting. It's just, that's all it is. It's just constantly adjusting to all the things, to your body changing, sort of your health changing, your physical appearance changing, who you want in your life changing, all of that. But style is no different. And I'm always like, oh, that just doesn't look good anymore. And you know, I've been trying all kinds of shit in the last like year and a half. And I'm like, no, like I have a leather mini skirt and I was about to throw it out. And I was like, actually, with tights and a turtleneck sweater, this looks amazing. So, you know, it's just adjusting. I used to wear it in a different way, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's just retrying on your stuff. But I also think, it's trying things. I think it's trying out a lot of different things because, you know, we are in this weird amorphous style place. And it's just like, well, what feels good and still looks good? And what do I want to try that I haven't tried before? For example, you know, I am, as discussed, I think where I've landed right now is 70s lesbian. I'll keep saying it. And that took a lot of trial and error to really land squarely. And now I'm like, I want 3-piece suits and skinny ties.
You're set.
That's where I'm headed. I mean, why not? I never want to wear a heel again.
Oh my God. I've got to go to a friend's 50th birthday party in a couple weeks.
What are you going to wear?
I don't fucking know. Oh. She listens too. Meredith, I don't know what I'm going to wear at a birthday party. I'm for real. State about it. I don't know what to wear.
Oh God.
And it's in the country. It's in Connecticut.
Okay.
So it's like not in the city. That somehow changes things. I don't know what it changes.
You're not in a movie set.
Oh, it just, something about it being Connecticut just throws me.
I get what you mean. I mean, oh God. Well, that's the thing. I think that particularly the pandemic has stolen my idea of what it is to get dressed up. Like, I think I can get dressed normal, but getting dressed up is outside of my purview in a profound way. I mean, I don't know. Would you consider menswear?
I dress like a man every day anyway.
I know. So why not just lean fully into it? Why not go full Pamela Adlon and just be like, I'm wearing a really sweet looking tuxedo jacket.
You're right.
And a nice pair of pants. Just fucking go for it.
A nice pair of pants. I don't have a nice pair of pants.
Well, maybe that's the thing you splurge on. And then some kind of funky fun shoe.
That's the thing my brother says about me. My brother's like, you've got pretty good style, but your taste in shoes is tricky.
I will tell you that I bought a pair of, what is it? It's got the worst name. It's like from the office of Angela Scott or something.
Yes,
I
forget. Yes.
I bought the worst. I mean, not that is the worst name. I bought the best pair of Chelsea boots from her. And I wear them with everything and they're really quite awesome. They have such a good like Bob Dylan-y kind of shape, you know, mm-hmm. that like very mm-hmm. perfect 60s shoe. But I do think that that's a place to splurge for sure. But I dressed up a couple of years ago. I was thinking about this. The last time I really had to get dressed up, I had on like a gown and I really was like, oh, this is the last time I'm going to wear something like this. I felt so fucking stupid. I had like my arms exposed, a lot of makeup on, very feminine hair, and this very kind of feminine, like not prom dress, but like a feminine dress. A frilly gown. And I was like, ugh, I'm done. This is fucking over. And I do think women look incredible as we get older in pantsuits. Not pantsuit nation pantsuits, like a Pamela Adlon suit.
Or the other, like this is another outfit that I think you have to be formal. Mm-hmm. Looks really nice. It's like some kind of really fancy button-down shirt, mm-hmm. and then a long skirt.
I think that looks great too. I do too.
Tawny Goodman, who was an editor at Vogue for years and years, wore an outfit like that to the CFDA Awards when she won it. And mm-hmm. I think about it all the time. I just think like that is the perfect black tie.
I also like, I've been more, well, you know, I'm all about neck shit. I mean, I like a really beautiful scarf at the neck. I think that can really look nice depending on what the rest of the outfit is. I don't know. I feel very lost here too, but I'm like vests fucking fine. I don't know.
Like I kind of like vests right now too. I haven't worn one, but I'm very tempted. I do. I need to just accept that I dress like a boy. And just
I think so in. Too. That's where I'm at too, because really when I'm looking at all of this frilly shit that's out right now, well, it's either frilly or it's skanky. And, you know, I'm all for like, go for an S&M, like kind of sexy, you know, bondagey kind of shirt. It's not for me anymore, but I get it. Like, I get it. You're young, you're sexy, you want your tits out. Great. Who gives a shit? It's no longer for me. And so finding what is for me and like what it is beautifully tailored clothes.
Yep.
Simple clothes.
Yeah, I think the older you get, the simpler it gets. And that doesn't have to be boring.
It doesn't, because it can be a bright color. It can be all kinds of a pop of color. I saw someone make fun of you for it, and I laughed because I don't think you know how many times I threw in pop of color in a lucky caption because I knew it would pass. I knew.
Not what I thought you were gonna say.
No, I was like, fuck, I just gotta get this page through and she'll always accept a pop of color. Oh my god. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And also just investing in like cool shoes. I bought a pair of red ankle boots a couple of years ago, and unfortunately, they were not like a good brand and they were very uncomfortable. Like they caused me, I had to go to the chiropractor every time after I wore them because they just like, they threw my hips out. But I really liked them. Like I really liked the look of them. And I think sometimes, I mean, look, this is just old lady shit. Having like a plain outfit with like a pop of color on your foot.
It's just a funky boot. Yeah.
A funky boot is the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes there can be like a nice long, if it fits you correctly, like a long dress with a fitted blazer over it. It's like also anything that gives you kind of shape at the top, I feel like, you know,
yeah.
That gives you the appearance of a waist, but without being constricting, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I've been obviously thinking about all this stuff a lot because I'm looking at my closet post pandemic and I'm like, oh God, like, no, never again.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny. I just look at my closet and go, okay, I'll wear what I wore yesterday. Pretty much.
I feel like I go into panic. I feel like I go into panic when I have to see people now. Like when I had to pack for New York and I knew there were going to be six days of having to see people and show up in professional situations. It was really, really fucking stressful. And then I wound up buying a stupid dress that I had been stalked, that had been stalking me on Instagram.
It's a cute dress.
It is a goddamn tent. It is a tent, and it has, and there's no way to disguise that it's a tent because it also has giant sleeves. It's just an impossible, I might as well have just put on it. I literally might as well have put on a tent. Like it's that big and it's in a nice fabric, but it's just like this, I just look like it's just this giant thing. And I'm never buying another thing on Instagram again. That is my real vow. Because it's too manipulative, and you start, I feel like it does something to your brain. You see the same thing one time, you click on it, it stalks you everywhere you go.
Yeah, no, I haven't worn clothes online at all, on Instagram or anywhere. And not surprisingly, I've made a lot fewer mistakes in my shopping.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I really shouldn't say that as somebody who makes her living off a shopping blog, but it's true. You know, I don't order as many clothes because I don't have a doorman and things get stolen from my stoop. And it's really like it's cut down on the mistakes, but it's also cut down on the successes
and
the fun.
I've been buying some vintage things. I've been buying a bunch of vintage linen pieces from a brand called Flax because I've been like, oh, maybe I also have another. Oh my God, another. I think her name's Fiona Shaw. Another style icon. If anybody watches Killing Eve, Fiona Shaw style is on Killing Eve, especially this last season, is everything I want. And it does involve a lot of suits. And she doesn't have a perfect body. It's like, you can make this shit work for you. We think we can't. A lot of like silk button downs that can be really beautiful, I think. And a lot of linen. That's where we are.
The other thing is like when you buy something vintage, you may get something for like $50 or $40 or something cheap, but then you have to realize that the real money spending comes, like the important, I don't know what I'm saying.
No, I do know what you're saying.
You need a tailor. You take the thing you bought and you get a tailor.
Absolutely. And I have to start doing that. I never do that. I'm like, no, I'm going to get rid of it. The other thing, though, is while we're talking about all of this is all of our style concerns. We are actually the most in style right now. If you saw the internet trending of Coastal Grandma, which is like, did you see this? Yes. This is what all the youngs want to dress like, a coastal grandma, like Diane Keaton in a Nancy Myers movie. And I'm like, oh, that's me. So it's
Coastal
fine.
Grandma. Okay, fair enough. I'm somehow coastal grandma without ever actually having been a mother, but I'm going to do it.
Or without ever having lived, like I've never lived in a beach house. Like it's
coastal grandma. It's
that's
hilarious.
Me, coastal grandma. We're not going to title the episode this though, because out of respect for Rebecca Soffer, we're not going to title
it into your head. You were like Coastal Grandma. That's
Coastal
it.
Grandmas. That's the title. And fuck no, we can't. All right. Well, do you want to get into the episode?
Let's get into it.
Our guest today is Rebecca Soffer. Rebecca co-founded the Modern Loss website, which provides support for those who are grieving and explores grief in all its forms. She's also the co-author of Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief, and the author of the published when this comes out, The Modern Loss Handbook, an interactive guide to moving through grief and rebuilding your resilience. She has written for the New York Times, Time, Elle, Marie Claire, and Health, among other publications. And she worked as producer on The Colbert Report. Welcome, Rebecca. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, both of you.
We're super excited to talk to you about a sad topic. Kim, sorry, I cut you off.
Isn't that weird? Like a lot of people say that to me. They're like, I'm like really excited to talk to you. And that feels weird because we're going to talk about grief. And I'm like, well, you know, that just shows how badly we need to talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. And can I just say, it's such a tricky topic that I was like kind of dreading it today, you know? And one of my questions to you was, why is there so little conversation about this? But I know why there's no conversation about it, or little conversation, because it's a bummer. But before we get to that, I want to ask you how it was that you first became involved in the topic of grieving.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question, because if you even talk to me for 10 minutes about anything besides grief, you would wonder, why does this person work in grief? Because like, it's not necessarily my jam. And yet it very much is. So I'm a journalist, and I was working, you know, I went to Columbia Journalism School. And then right from there, I started working for the Colbert Report. I was on the original staff there. And that was my view of like how I could contribute to journalism. And I just loved it. And I felt like I was really building up my life and my career, and going to finally get rid of all the college crap in my apartment. I was, you know, 30 in Manhattan, which we know is like 18 in other parts of the universe. My mother was killed in a car accident just shortly after my 30th birthday, a few months afterward. And I was just like stunned into a state of overwhelm that lasted for so long because the rug had been pulled out from underneath my feet during a time when I was so focused on the build phase of my life. Like I was like, all right, got the degree. Like I'm working in political satire. Oh my gosh, I'm getting paid like one penny a year to do this amazing job. I'm so excited. Here are all my plans. And like that plan did not include like suddenly dead mom, who happened to be my very best friend in the universe. And I had to figure out a way to navigate the build phase while also navigating the extreme loss phase and doing it when I still had to pay rent and I still had to figure out my early 30s shit, which, you know, involved maybe finding a partner and dating and getting a dog and all that. And I still had to work. Like I wanted to move forward in my career. And it became very evident very quickly how much we suck at this conversation, because I felt like I was surrounded by like so many amazing people in my life, from my friends to my coworkers. And my coworkers came to my mom's funeral in a rented van. They all poured out of it. But after that day, it's like, what do you do for that person? And it's really hard to know what to do for somebody when the culture does a really poor job of telling you how to talk about it or giving you the language. Nobody had the language. And also very few people had the firsthand shared experience of profound loss. And so I was just in this weird phase of like not being a child and being surrounded by structures that might've legally or emotionally or familially had a responsibility to catch me. And I wasn't, you know, 90. I was just like 30 and trying to build my life. And then all of a sudden I had this. And so why do I work in grief? Because of that, because of how incredibly lonely it was and how desperately I wished that I could talk about it in a way that wouldn't bring the record to like this uncomfortable screeching halt whenever I brought it up. Like I just felt so abnormal about a situation that I now know is the most normal thing you can go through.
Right. I read that you said you felt like you were getting a D minus in grief.
Yeah.
How did you turn that around?
Yeah. At best, I thought I was getting a D minus. Because, you know, I really felt like I was flailing for some time. My mom died very suddenly. It was extremely traumatic for me. My dad was in the car with her and survived. I had just seen them an hour beforehand. I'm their only child, you know, between the two of them. And so it was so lonely for so long. I was in this state of like, I couldn't even listen to music, and I love music. Like I played violin for 15 years. I couldn't even listen to gentle music, you know, much less like my favorite music. It felt like sensory overload, you know, it felt like almost insulting to my ears. It was too much to read a book. It felt like all too much, you know? And I just felt like I was failing because I kept getting told with like hands on my shoulders, either literally or metaphorically, like it takes a year, or like I did get told that they're in a better place, which like don't ever say that. Please don't ever say that to anyone, people, please. It just never worked.
And everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, like it doesn't. Yeah. So I kept getting told like, you know, these, I kept feeling like I was being assured by people who felt like they knew that it would be okay, that it takes a year, that they're in a better place, like all of these things. But I wasn't being told how it would be better or like what would happen after a year. Like I wasn't being given any examples of how I could move through this like crazy, insane mess that seemed to take total control of me 90% of the time and then 10% of the time make me feel like maybe I could like navigate it. I didn't understand like how I could move through this in a way that was going to get me to a place where I could be joyful again and like feel like I was like living a life. I mean, like you hear how I speak, I have a lot of energy. Like I love my friends. I love laughing. I love music and theater and feeling alive and inspired. But for so long, I felt so little of that. And I felt so scared. And it was because I felt so lonely. And I felt like there, I wasn't being given any really earnest, like, I mean it invitations to talk about my shit outside my therapist's office.
And do you think that sort of that had to do with the age you were when you lost your mother and the fact that so few people your age could relate to what you were going through? I lost a father when I was in college, and my father. And I felt like people didn't even begin to know how to talk to me about it at that age.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I absolutely think that age came into play. Mostly because, you know, like, you have to keep in mind, I was working like really long days. I was working in daily television. So I didn't have a huge variety. My life was not balanced. I would go into a studio, whatever, in the morning and then come out after we taped the show, which was at, I think at that time, like 7 at night. Maybe I was out at 8:15. And I was exhausted. And I would just go home and stare at the wall. And I didn't want to think, you know, but I would just go home and like just kind of shut out all the lights and like try and like drown out the rest of the world for a little bit. And so I felt like I wasn't able to see so many people during that time because I was working, as most of us are when we're 30. I was so focused on trying to do a good job at my job so that I could actually have a career, so that I could move up. But I was struggling with balancing it out with like getting the right grief support and then also figuring out a way to kind of check in with myself on a continual basis and figure out what I needed and then figure out a way to ask not just my employers, but my friends to help me get what I needed so that I could give to them what they needed.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I just feel like, because of our age, sure, but also because I think at that point in time, I mean, we're talking about 15 years ago, we were really bad at talking about grief, you know, like we're still kind of bad at it now. We were much worse, you know, doing it in a way that like wasn't anchored in like a clinical conversation or a religious conversation or like a really lame platitude laden conversation, you know? And so the discomfort level was so high that I think it was also just a societal thing as well as an age thing.
Take a quick break for some ads.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And we're back. Do you think that we feel, do you think there's shame surrounding grief? Do you think that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. I'm wondering. And then my real question, well, and I wonder why you think that is, but then my real question is, what did you need? People didn't know what you needed. What did you need?
I needed I need my needs changed on a daily basis. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I wanted to make it clear that, like, it's called a handbook. It's not called the how to, because I'm telling you, these are all the things I've learned. These are all the things that, like, the community has learned. And here's some expert based information, but, like, take it or leave it. Like, you need to try this and see if it works for you. And if it doesn't, try something else. So my needs really changed on an ongoing basis. You know, there were some days where my productivity was changing at work because my sleep schedule was so off, because I was having so many awful dreams that I couldn't sleep at night. And so I felt like I was, you know, just full of energy and I wanted to use it somehow instead of, like, laying awake and staring at the ceiling. And so I wished that I could have used that time to kind of maybe work a little bit. I wish that I could have maybe come in to work a little bit later. I wish that I could have been given time off a few months down the line after my mom's death to do things that I really needed to do, like sort through all of her things and pack them up, which you don't really think to do, nor should you have to do, like 3 days after she dies in a car accident. I had needs from my friends, which were, you know, for them to kind of stop pussyfooting around the topic and acting like whenever they brought it up, they were reminding me of something yes. that I had somehow miraculously forgotten, which I didn't, you know. I had needs from friends who were my best friends, some of my best friends at the time. Keep in mind the age, I was 30. A lot of my friends were in build mode. It wasn't their fault. You know, one of my best friends was a medical resident. I mean, you know, come on. Like, she was being, like, hazed at the hospital every day. But she was, like, one of my best friends. And I remember, like, she could never see me. And this was my, like, one of my best friends could never see me after my mom was killed on the Jersey Turnpike. And I was so angry with her because she couldn't be there for me, you know? And so, like, I needed her. I needed my friend, you know? And we couldn't figure out a way for her to be there for me if it wasn't physically, you know? So my needs were always changing. But what I wasn't good at was checking in with myself and getting to a place where I felt confident in asking for what I needed. Because it was really clear that a lot of people really did want to support me. They just didn't exactly know how, which is why I think in loss, you get a lot of people saying, if there's ever anything I can do, like, they actually mean it. They do. I think people in general really want to help out and be supportive, but they don't know what they can do because they don't know what you needed. They can't intuit, like, magically where you're at, you know?
And I think they also assume that you're, like, you will collapse like a house of cards if the topic comes up.
There was a lot of, like, don't bring it up, like, just don't bring it up, like, okay. And I'm like, literally, I'm fully aware that my mom is dead. Like, you're not going to remind me on Mother's Day that I have a dead mom. Like, I'm aware, you know, like, you can text me and tell me how shitty this day must be for me. And it's not going to make me feel worse. In fact, it's going to make me feel so much better. It's going to make me feel acknowledged, because all you really want, let's be honest, when you get decked where it hits and you are so in pain and scared and unsure of what your life is going to look like, unsure of what tomorrow is going to look like, you just want to feel like you're not alone in it. Even just for, like, a few minutes, you want to feel like someone is seeing you in that awful space and willing to sit with you in it and not offer any solutions or fixes or ideas. You just want to feel acknowledged, right? In anything, not just in grief, in anything that is difficult in life. And I think that's, like, the secret of all of this, which is people are like, oh my God, I don't know the right thing to do, blah, blah, blah. It really is. Figure out a way to make it clear to somebody that their grief isn't going to scare you off and you're highly aware that it is not contagious.
Right. How about when somebody dies who you had a complicated relationship with? What journey does grief take when that happens?
I mean, I think it takes, you know, the journey is a rough one. I think all relationships are complicated, and I think that very few ones when there is a death, are in a state where everything is tied up with like a beautiful little satin bow, you know, because people are people and humans are super fallible. But relationships are difficult. There are relationships that are meaningful that still carry a lot of pain and hurt and resentment and damage. And when one of those people dies in that dynamic, the really hard thing is that, first of all, closure is like a literal mythical term. I don't believe in it. But for lack of a better term, there will not ever be any time where that person can ever talk to the other person and get to a different place. It's going to be a one-sided conversation. And it's something that like the onus is on the survivor to contend with all these remaining feelings and figure out how to live with them and move through them, not move on, move through them. And I think that's a really hard thing to do, you know, and that's where I believe in the enormous power of a very good grief therapist, but also the power of community support and peer-to-peer support, because you could drive yourself crazy being alone in your head about this stuff.
I wonder if you think our definitions of grief are too limited. It feels like to me, grief permeates so many aspects of our lives. And I think we are, you know, we think of grief often as just in death, but there's grief over the loss of marriages. I think there's grief over the loss if you had a traumatic childhood. There's grief over a loss of a childhood. I think there's a lot of grief in midlife over your life. And COVID, something like COVID certainly made us collectively grieve. Do you think that we need to be more expansive in our definitions about grief and approach it similarly in some ways?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. I absolutely do not think that grief is merely tied to the death of someone who was once living. I think that grief, to me, if it feels like grief to you, then it's grief. Kind of like porn, right? Like you'll know it when you see it. Right. Oh my God, I cannot believe I'm quoting. Who was it?
The Larry senator. Flint. Whatever. Is that? No, but, it's yeah, not Larry Flint. Like, this case was Larry Flint.
Yeah, I actually don't feel like much talking about the Senate today. but yeah, like I feel like if it feels like grief to you, then it's grief and it's valid. It's worthy of examining and respecting and honoring. Because like, when was the last time that someone said, oh, just calm down or oh, just relax, and it actually worked on you or just tried to talk you out of your feelings, right? Yeah. Like, how does that go? Like, you know, how does that go for you? It doesn't go well. So like, if it feels like grief to someone or someone close to you, you should probably respect it as being such, because you're not going to talk them out of how they're feeling. And you might as well acknowledge that what is happening is really difficult and figure out ways, you know, at least if you care about them, to talk them through what they can do about it. We are in a state of enormous grief right now. We are 2 years into this awful, ghastly pandemic that has killed way more than 1 million people in this country. I mean, I think the unofficial tally is 200,000 people more than 1 million. So 1.2 million at this point. People are still dying from other reasons as well. Also, we have had the loss of so many things. We have lost so many coping mechanisms over the last 2 years. We have lost the ability to hug people without fear. We've lost the ability to just go to the gym or access that Sunday brunch that we figured out was the thing that we're going to hang our sanity on every week to get through the week during a tough time. We've lost dreams for the future and over our perceived control of the future, which we never had. But, you know, I think a lot of us like to think that we had an idea of what our lives were going to look like. And we've lost a lot of those ideas because they haven't come to fruition. And we've lost roles. We've lost jobs. We've lost the dynamic in our lives if people have died. And then there's also the grief over societal stuff. There have been hate crimes. There's been political grief. There's been fear with what's going on in public policy and law. there's been so much divisiveness over whether a piece of cloth is something you should put on your mouth and nose, and all, and maybe looking at people in different ways because of it, because of how we know that they feel now. All of this is grief. It's all grief. It's all worthy of acknowledgement, because if you don't acknowledge it, you're simply not going to be able to move through it and build resilience and try and figure out what you can take from this awfulness that is meaningful.
Right. Right.
I think about the whole idea of grieving correctly, you know, like things like, you know, my mom is eternally bothered by the fact that she didn't cry at my stepfather's funeral. And yet when she had to put her dog down, she was just a complete mess. Like, why? I had a question at the beginning of this. I'm trying to remember it. But no, why is grief so black and white sometimes and other times so complicated or hard to access?
Well, I mean, I personally don't think grief is ever black and white. I think it's like a huge shade of gray that has a lot of lighter hues and a lot of darker hues. And I think it's something that, you know, it's just like there are no rules in grief. You know, maybe your father dies and you don't have an outward reaction like you think you should. But that doesn't mean you're not still grieving and processing, and that your neurons are literally trying to like rejigger, right, trying to figure out, like, I mean, I read this book, The Grieving Brain, and I was like, ah, like I feel so seen, because it literally like made me feel better for still going to call my mom sometimes. She died in 2006. I still sometimes go to call her because she's still in my phone. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, God, you're such an idiot. And I got the validation that no, our brains literally have trouble because this is a known thing to them. Like, this is just a fact that this person is in the world. And it takes a really long time for them to adapt to the fact that, like, what is proven is no longer. Like, it's not us. It's not us. No, there's no amount of trying that can, like, get us to grieve in, like, a more proper way.
I also wonder with the shame, I think that shame and guilt are just a place that's easier for us to handle in some ways, because it puts it on us. You know, it feels more controlled. If I'm bad, then I can control this in a way. Whereas grief probably, I imagine, feels so out of control for all of us. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like shame is a go-to and guilt is a go-to oftentimes as a way to control that which is uncontrollable. Because at least if you can feel like a piece of shit yourself, that feels like something tangible rather than the like morass of sadness and mourning and just like that could swallow you up in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, look, people feel a wide variety of these feelings, and often they will feel all of them at some point. And sometimes they'll feel all of them in one day. I have.
Yeah.
That's a fun roller coaster. But I think that we are really good at feeling shame and grief because our society does a really bad job of making it clear that this is a very, very, very human, normal thing to go through. And instead, it makes us feel like it's a little bit pathologized if after a certain period of time, you're not in a certain place. And so I think a lot of like, yes, there's a lot of shame associated with like, oh my God, if I had only with this person, if only, like, I know what you are talking about with regard to the person who died. But there's also a lot of shame when we compare ourselves to like the mile markers of like where society says we should probably be. And I think that's total bullshit. And I really hate that. I hate that we promote that idea of a timeline, because there is no timeline. I mean, there's a new diagnosis in the DSM-5, which is called prolonged grief disorder, which I don't know if you've read about, but there was an article in the Times a couple months ago going deep into it. And, you know, it basically says that it basically gives grief a reason to be covered by insurance, but it suggests that if after a year you are just really not able to glean any enjoyment from life or function properly, you know, go to work, et cetera, that this is like a pathology. This is a disorder. And the issue with that is that about 15, no more percent of people who are suffering profound grief are going to experience that real inability to like move through this in a way that is functional. But that's an extreme minority percentage. Right. We're right. talking about 100%. And a lot of these symptoms you can find in the DSM and other places like anxiety and depression and et cetera. So why do you have to make a grief definition? Why can't you just diagnose it as other things that are stemming, that are associated with grief? Because you're going to find bereaved parents who say they're never going to feel utter joy again years down the line. That doesn't mean that they're not, that doesn't mean that they have a disorder or that they're abnormal or that they have something wrong with them. That means that they lost a child and there's no way that they feel like they're ever going to feel whole again. And so I feel like there's this perception when we have definitions like this, prolonged grief disorder, American society likes to fix things. We like fixing things. We like having ideas for things, for making things better. But there's no like grief vaccine. You just have to move through it. There's no way around it. There's no way. You can't shortcut it. And so when we have definitions like this or diagnoses, my fear is that there's going to be a societal perception that something is wrong with them after a year. And then there's going to be this shame that is prolonged, and they're going to think, oh, well, I guess something's really wrong with me. I guess I need to go on meds, or I need this. And I love meds, who cares, you know, but like there are a variety of modalities that can help people who are grieving and then by extension, living with loss. And a lot of that is in finding societal support, feeling like you're supported at work, feeling like you have friends who are willing to talk to you about this stuff, feeling like you can talk to other people, like peer-to-peer support in loss, meeting friends who are going through something kind of similar, even if they don't become good friends, people who you could just talk to about this and feel seen by and get ideas from and be commiserated with and you know, validated by. And so I feel like if we did that better, then the shame spiral would not be so great.
Right, right. Can we talk for a minute about that living with loss? Because you've written about how important you think it is to keep a person alive in your life and alive in your mind. How do you manage that if you're still in a place where you're feeling intense pain?
Well, you know, so what I do, modern loss is really about the long arc of loss, right? Because we're not just talking about my mom just died last month or last year even. I mean, I'm talking to both of you as a woman whose mom died 15 years ago and her dad died 10 years ago. And I still have hard moments that pop up. And I have amazing moments too. And what I want to do is promote loss as like a companion. It's like your 24/7, 365 day a year companion for the rest of your life after you lose somebody. And so, yeah, like there will be times, and especially in early grief, when everything feels painful. And I don't think that there's much to do about that. That's grief, you know? You're adapting to the absence of somebody who was meaningful in your life. And I don't want to be like a Pollyanna, toxic positive person and be like, well, just think about this. Think about all the good times. No, it's like really shitty for a while. There's no way around it. And if I said otherwise, then I should probably be called out for it. But as time goes on, what I would love people to know is that their relationship is still alive with that person, even though the person is dead. I still have a very like dynamic relationship with my parents, even though they're not here. Now, do I wish that they were here for dinner? I could talk to, do I wish it could actually be a conversation? Yeah, of course Of course I do. Like, do I wish that they could meet my kids and my kids can meet them? It's never going to happen. I absolutely wish that, but that's not going to happen. And so all I have is the memories I have of them and the wishes and desires that I would have hoped to, you know, experience with them. And as I get older, I regard them differently. Like, I see my mom more as like a woman now. Unless, you know, I always see her as my mom, but I also see her more as like a woman who had kids or had a kid and who might've struggled with like her identity a little bit after having a kid. Like, who am I? What the hell's going on? Is it just this, you know, or is there more, you know? I never thought about her like that beforehand. Like, when she died and I was in my early 30s, I didn't think about her like that. And so to regard her differently, to me, is a really beautiful thing because it makes me feel very connected to her. It does.
I've had a similar experience with my father because he was 49 when he died.
Oh my gosh.
And we had a difficult relationship. And when I reached the age that he died and then past the age that he died, I started being able to see him not as my father, but as a man. You know, a man who grew up in the 50s and thought he should go to college and get married and everything else, you know, that you do kind of reach a different place when you lose a parent at any point, when you see them as another person.
Yeah.
So
there's also this like really, and I say rich, by the way, for like lack of a better term, because it's kind of crappy, but like I'm not the age that my mom was when she died, but I gather that if I'm lucky enough to get older and, you know, get to the age where she died, that that's going to be really weird for me, you know, like that's another type of grief. And I think that that's, you know, something that we don't talk about enough as well. Like, the message that I just hope people get is that it's not like a one and done thing. It's not this like 365 day period of time. And then like you've moved on to the next stage. It's a very much living, breathing thing. And the more you can kind of accept that, I think that not like the easier, because it's not easy, but I think the easier it gets to at least move through it, because you're not going to be so shocked when you get slammed by a wave. You're going to know that they still come. They'll still be hard, but you're going to expect them at some point.
I wonder if there are ways to prepare for grief. My mother-in-law recently brought me to her cemetery plot. I was visiting her and she walked me over and she said, you know, I just want you to see this. It started making me prepare for this one. I'm very close to my mother-in-law, this woman who will die, you know, she's older. Do you think about that there's ways to prepare for it? There's ways to sort of steel yourself for it. I don't know if that's a dumb question. I think about it sometimes.
I think that you can do as much as you can do, but you're never going to be fully prepared for when it happens. I think a lot of people struggle with anticipatory grief when there's a diagnosis or when they know that a parent is just getting older and ailing and they're kind of like mentally preparing themselves like, okay, not going to be around forever. Or maybe there's dementia and you're losing that person. You're losing that person who they were. You're watching them fade away and you're missing them. You're grieving them, but they're still there. But there is nothing that can prepare you for the feeling of when they finally die. Just to draw an example for people who would like to understand. I mean, can we all agree that we're pro-choice on this podcast?
Yes, 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 we can.
You know, and all these posts when the news broke about the leaked, you know, SCOTUS agreement. And I saw all these posts saying, I knew that it was coming in my mind, but like, I didn't think I was going to feel like this when it actually happened, when I actually knew. And that's just very much the same. That's grief, by the way.
Yeah.
Like talking about grief, that's grief.
How about when somebody is sick for a while and it's a relief when they die? It's a relief. Like how that, I think, is a feeling that a lot of people have a lot of shame and guilt around.
Absolutely.
When it's natural, right?
Yes.
To watch someone suffer to be relieved when they're finally not suffering.
Absolutely. And I think it's something that like we have to talk about more. Like there is nothing wrong with feeling relief, especially if you were a caregiver, especially if you were, you know, like having to live far away from that person. Maybe you're working and your dad is sick on the other side of the country and you're, oh my God, it's torture to not be able to be there with him and support him, but you can't. And there's so much guilt. And so when there's a death, there is sometimes a feeling of relief, like, oh my God, like a relief that they're of course no longer in pain. Yes, we are all relieved about that, but also that maybe we don't have to go to bed with the phone next to our ear. That's what happened with me when my dad died. That was the first night that I left my phone in the other room because I was like, well, they're both gone now. There's no one, no late night calls to get. And I slept with the phone next to my ear for years in between my mom's and my dad's death, 4 years. Mm. And I was really worried about his health and all that. And, you know, it was only when he died, that I felt that relief of like, well, the dread is gone or like the other shoe is dropped. And you know what? Like that doesn't make you a bad person. That just makes you human.
Right.
You know, that's not a reflection of how you felt about them.
Right. Has thinking about grief so much, has it changed your relationship to your own mortality, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously I think about grief a lot. And I think that I was always someone, you know, I was always like a carpe diem type person. I mean, I don't think that I have fundamentally changed as a person. I don't think that people fundamentally change. But I have grown a little bit more into that whole carpe diem-ness. I am really aware that we aren't being given like a Dave and Buster's card with like a certain amount of credits that like, okay, we have this many credits left. And like, then when we're done, we're done. That's not a lifespan. A lifespan can be any period of time, any number of credits, right? And so I don't know what the charge on my card is. You know, I hope it's a decent one, but it could not be that. And so I almost feel like I'm definitely not comparing myself to Alexander Hamilton, like at all, by the way, but it's just, I do bring up musical theater a lot. And you know, there's this song, like, why does he write like he's running out of time? And you know, his parents died. And I feel like I'm always running out of time. And not in a morose way, by the way, not in a morbid way. I don't sit around being like, I'm dying. Like, no, no. Like I feel very much alive. I'm wearing metallic tassels today. Like, come on. But I'm very aware that loss is present every day, even if there's not a death. Like, this moment is never going to return. This experience, this day is never going to come back, you know? And that doesn't mean that I, like, take full advantage of every day, but it does mean that I'm a lot more aware of it.
Rebecca, I think that's a really good place to stop. That was amazing. Thank you so much. And everybody should really get this book. It is such a useful, useful book. I really think it's also beautiful. And you've obviously given a lot of thought to it. And I think that it will be a very helpful gift, actually, for people.
I agree. I have to say, like, I really do wish that someone had handed me something like this, not just in the months, but in the years after my mom died, because I got a lot of edible arrangements. I got a lot of casseroles. I got a lot of, you know, arugula. And I can only eat so much. And I certainly don't think there's anything wrong with giving someone something that can help them. I really wanted to help myself. I did. I felt like this exposed little baby You know, I felt so tiny and small and so vulnerable. And I wanted to feel resilient and strong, but I didn't exactly know how to get there. And so, yeah, like I do wish someone, that's why I wrote it, you know?
Totally, totally. It is the Modern Loss Handbook, an interactive guide to moving through grief and building your resilience. And Rebecca, where can people find you?
I run Modern Loss, which is modernloss.com. You can find the book wherever books are sold. And you can find Modern Loss everywhere at Modern Loss and at Rebecca Sofer on all the platforms. And I also run our newsletter on Substack. So it's modernloss.substack.com, which I really love. I do a monthly deep dive interview with a notable figure about loss and grief. And, you know, we've had Cynthia Nixon and we've had Stacey London, and I love it. And then we have a premium membership, which gives people access to monthly virtual sessions like yoga for grief support, mindfulness sessions. We just did an amazing session on competitive grieving, which, oh my gosh, that was that's a conversation. Funny. So yeah, I mean, like we're out there everywhere, and we're, the best part is like when you need us, come on in, like we're not going to bite. And when you don't, that's cool. You can ignore us for a bit, but we're still going to be there when you need us again.
That's great. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And good luck with the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Everything Is Fine. We're your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it on all the platforms. Every other week, we're reading out reviews, 5-star reviews. Please leave them. You want to find this show on Instagram? We are at EIF Podcast. We have a Patreon. If you want to support the production of the show, it's patreon.com/everythingisfine. We're on Twitter. We have a private Facebook group that folks seem to be enjoying. If you want to find Kim, you can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com. And you can find me at my newsletter occasionally, tinyletter.com/Jennifer Romolini.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.